were you watching?
Culture Hop, I guess. I was watching a short film from the guy who had done Funeral Parade of Roses.
Yeah.
It was his first film that he did, called My Damaged Right Eye.
Yeah, I saw that in the Wikipedia entry. The title of that work. And yeah. I immediately thought of John Fell Ryan. But how is it?
You're really loud right now. Maybe.
Okay. How's that?
That's better.
I'm a loud talker, so it could just be not a technical issue, just a personal quirk. So were you able to watch this on YouTube?
Yeah, it's on some, maybe YouTube. Yeah, I think, yeah, YouTube. Maybe I need to turn my shit down. That might help. Oh, yeah, my stuff is way too up. I'm over here. I might be projecting. See that?
I've heard of that. You know, I was able to watch about the first 30 minutes of the feature-length film that guy did, The Parade of Roses. And certainly powerfully, like, what year was that made? In 1969?
Nine.
I mean, and a buried kind of work of art, right? I mean, how did, had you heard of this film prior to that comment left in a post? Like, is this?
No, the first time, no, I heard about it from Alan. I don't know if it was like a month ago or something like that. But yeah, as an influence for Clockwork Orange, which is really apparent, like you can see it totally. Like especially the Crow of a Milk Bar, and there's just the way the things are shot too. You can just see the new wave Japanese influence on the Clockwork Orange. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I feel like a dick for not having watched that, so I can't really comment towards that influence. I will say that. Where was it written that Kubrick... Well, you're just saying it wasn't written anywhere that Kubrick had seen this film. It just is almost blatantly obvious that this would be something that he would have had to have seen because the influences are just so apparent.
Well, the way it was phrased in Wikipedia, I believe, it kind of suggests that it's like... It's openly expressed, I guess. It's obvious. Like, I don't see how it couldn't be the case. You can just see it, you know. But then that brings us to Sophia Stewart kind of deal, because it's like you look at the thing and you look at this thing and you're like, well, of course. But and then I was also looking at Vinyl, the Andy Warhol version of The Clockwork Orange that came out before Kubrick's. And that's something you can, they're similar in certain ways, but I've only seen clips of it. I haven't seen the whole film, but it's definitely a different take on it.
So Vinyl is one of the films that Andy Warhol had made in the 60s, and it is based on the novel Clockwork Orange.
Yes.
It's obviously a different interpretation. Cinematically. What do you think is the theme that draws all these, or have you personally come to a conclusion, or are you reaching a conclusion why these three artists, these three movies, and this book are all interrelated? Is there anything that you're finding, or...
It's just a movement that was taking place, and I think a degree of insights that were shared along with that movement. I mean, the thing with Funeral Parade of Roses is that it's the Oedipal story. Oedipus. So, I mean, they're transvestites, and it's got this whole kind of, that's the subtext of the film. Admittedly so, it's not like a hidden thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because I was approaching The Shining from looking at it through that lens, with Danny, with his mother, and his, like, kill the father, fuck the mother kind of thing. And so especially that I like to play the final sequence of The Shining with the end, with a timing that came about from three albums before it. And the way that that particular song lines up for me feels totally uncanny. And so that's the theme of the end, is the Oedipus story. And so I had looked at that through that lens, but I hadn't thought to look at The Shining A Clockwork Orange in the same way. And so this kind of is inspiring me to do so. I noticed that, you know, you have the Andy Warhol film is called Vinyl. And then when you watch Funeral Parade of Roses, there's, I mean, obviously a vinyl theme going on, the records being mm-hmm. vinyl. But then there's a one part in that film where they flash the Beatles, what looks to be maybe like either Sgt. Pepper or Magical Mystery Tour era Beatles, just a flash, you know. But I mean, they take things from everywhere. There's a lot of the music, like Rolling Stones and whatnot, I believe, and stuff. And so there's the is it the Chelsea record store? I forget what the name of the record store is. There's a really great article on the record store in A Clockwork Orange. Maybe we can put up a link when we put up this this talk. But they show all the records that he walks past and all the little subliminal things that are in there. Some more obvious, like you can see the soundtrack to 2001 at the same moment when Alex is picking up on those two girls and he makes a comment about their popsicles, but that he does the thing with his cane that they do in Eyes Wide Shut when they're trying to when the women are responding in the mansion, you know, like he does the cane and then the women go to their knees or they stand up depending. And when he picks up on those women, he does the exact same. Alex does the same thing with his cane that's done in Eyes Wide Shut, which I find interesting. But besides that, up if you look up on the wall, you can see on one side Pink Floyd's Adam Hart Mother, the classic cow. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, you can see the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour. And then I couldn't help but like look at the ending of A Clockwork Orange, which isn't in the book in the same way. Like the book has a whole other chapter. Like he goes back and takes revenge on the people, you know, like they took revenge on him and then he takes revenge on them again, all the folks. But that ending where he's like in what to me looks like a grave, you know, and all mm-hmm. the people are clapping and he's having sex with that woman. And it's mm-hmm. all like, and he's like, I was cured. All right. And it's like that for me, I look at that and I'm like, it looks like a funeral parade. You know, so yeah, Funeral Parade of Roses is this influence, but I would question, like here on Wikipedia, it says the film was later a major influence of Stanley Kubrick's 1971 film, A Clockwork Orange. I would question like the degree of what is meant, what it actually means by influence. Like it's not just an influence of style. It's not just like an influence, like film wise, like he's like wants to go for that new age look. It might also be a symbolic influence as well as a subtext into the film. So I wonder about that. I want to look into that more.
Well, I immediately thought of with the Oedipal element with The Shining is when Danny and Wendy are watching television and on the screen is the movie Summer of 42. Mm-hmm. And it's a movie sure. where the young boy is seduced by the woman who is left alone without a husband because the husband's at war. And if you see in that scene, the young boy is wearing a brown jacket and a red shirt, which mirrors Danny when he's in the room watching cartoons. He's got the brown robe and the red shirt. And so with all the sort of incestual themes already being discussed with the Playgirl magazine. You have this Oedipal thing going on, but I don't think it's the desire of the son to fuck the mother there. I think it's the comfort of the mother with the baby. There's something right. about Wendy buffering her fear with the child on some level, that there's something comforting of a mother, like being back in baby's arms doesn't mean what you would think it means. It means like to have the child's arms around you. There's something safe. Like no one hurts a mother with her child. There's, I think psychologically, there's some safety and security if you have a child in your arms. You would think that you being the protector of the most vulnerable thing, people kind of give you a pass. They're not gonna attack you. Or like, I'm probably not explaining it too well, but
no, you are.
But there's a projection of that television screen that I think is something that's more compelling to Wendy in that moment. The TV is reflecting something going on inside her head, that she has this need for Danny that she's working out in her head.
Sure. I feel like it connects totally to Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite, being that you have these, like, when he goes beyond the infinite, where does he end up? But in this kind of, like, I don't know, what it's not Victorian, it's the same, whatever the mask is in the in Eyes Wide Shut, that's what the room is. But there's, like, these statues around, and there's these archetypes that are the gods, right? And so, like, I look at The Shining, first of all, as, like, a new Greek tragedy, which, like, the Oedipus story, but that in the story of Oedipus, you have these archetypes that the people are, like, unconscious of. And the point of the Oedipus story is that you can't escape your own fate, and that nothing can save you from your own fate, not even love. Like, there's no human, emotion or no human drive that can separate you from playing out these archetypes. Because even if you escape from one, you fall into another. It's like a Facebook thread where people are just role playing and they don't realize it. There's these archetypal roles, and they're just going back and forth. And it always comes through like the back door. They're like, oh, well, I'll go from this angle. But it's like, no, you can't escape the thing. And so like that feels to me like Jack in that picture on a certain level. You could look at it like he's become the caretaker. He's always been the caretaker. Yeah, don't threat on me. Yeah, ride the snake. Don't threat on me. You just can't separate yourself from this play. And so, and that for me feels like the meaning of the Seder chorus as well. It's that even though if you back up and are expressing like the undernetting of the play, and you're like, no matter how much you thrash about and express it on a different level, like you end up, it's still part of it. Everything gets incorporated into the play, no matter what. And so does that make sense?
Like, I think it makes sense. And I think I wanted to address with you the whole role of the Jacob story in regards to this, because I think it was LeClaire had recently written a post about the Jacob story and the damaged leg of Jacob, which resembles, you know, his brother Esau pulling on the ankle. And so Jacob is the son of Isaac, right?
It's Jacob the son of, no, Isaac is the son of Abraham. Jacob is the son of Joseph.
Okay, yes.
Or is that the opposite? Or is Joseph the son of Jacob? I forget how this works. I need to know my biblical story. It just felt like when I was growing up, I got tested on all this stuff, and now my focus has drifted way far into the esoteric side of it, and this only gets referenced, you know, it gets referenced differently. So I'm not as pushed to keep all of that in order, but it was coming up around that The Shining is for Stephen King's son, who was Joseph or Joe. And so I thought it was funny, like Joe King, like his name is Joe King. It's like,
are you kidding?
Do I look like I'm Joe King? I think of the Joker saying, do I look like I'm Joe King? this is the thing is that you have, Jacob is with the ladder, and they obviously, yes, you have the, and so the song that keeps repeating throughout The Shining, when in the mirror scene with Danny, is the vision of Jacob. That's the something along those lines. I mean, that's what the song is, the score that's playing in the score, that's super deep, and he sees the elevators open with the blood, and it's the same song that plays when Jack enters room 237, is Jacob's vision. And so, and then that's Stairway to Heaven. And then obviously you have this labyrinth in The Shining, which is very easily, you could look at it as Pan's Labyrinth. And so you have Dan and Pan. That was a connection Jake Kotza pointed out at one point in, like, I think the Seth Green thing. But anyways, you have, it's Dan's labyrinth that he's running through, and he's the one who leads Jack into it where he dies. And obviously this is a classic Greek story with the labyrinth, though, you know, it's not associated with Pan in the same way. That's more of a, as far as I know, seems to be a newer identification, but it's still completely applicable. I mean, I don't know enough about my Greek mythology, but I can't help but just, like, think about that. The idea of the labyrinth being the all, Pan is the all, everything exists within this labyrinth. You can choose different, you can choose to go a different way, but ultimately everything leads you to the center, which is once again expressing the Oedipal idea of fate. So it's like you go this way, but then you still end up in the center of the thing. This is like actually it would be a maze if there was dead ends, but in this case there is a dead end, but they still refer to it as a labyrinth, as I recall. Don't they say that? Like, we don't have John Fell Ryan on here, but I think that it says that on the sign when they show you the maze. Anyways, I want to Photoshop, like, that part where Jack is looking over the model of the maze. I want to put Pan's head from Pan's Labyrinth on Jack's head. But yeah, I think you might get where I'm going with that.
Yeah. Because I'm... Abraham, I should know this. Who was asked by God to sacrifice the son?
Abraham to kill Isaac. Who is
Abraham was supposed to take Isaac up the hill and sacrifice him as proof of his dedication to God. But at the last second, God says, whoa, 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 nice work.
So yeah, at the last second, he is stopped by an angel who grabs him by the arm or whatever. And that angel is taken by many to be Matot or Metatron.
Really?
And yeah, it's in my sync book chapter.
Okay, there you go.
But yeah, it's that's like a point that's really interesting. I mean, there's the in where they say that the temple itself was, they have a large stone within, and people go to this to pray. It's like a holy site in Jerusalem, and this is taken by Jews to be the sacrificial mound where Abraham was to sacrifice his son Isaac, and was stopped by Matot. But then the Muslims, not all of them, but many of them, consider the spot where the Kaaba was to be the same spot. And so it's really interesting just to think of the cube of the Kaaba is the spot of the sacrificial mound. So, and then that also for me calls to mind Pan's Labyrinth with the sacrifice at the full moon, and you know, how the sacrifice is stopped, but in the stopping of the sacrifice is the sacrifice, because she ends up getting killed anyway. But it, like, energetically, metaphorically, it's like the same story. Because there's a sacrifice that's happening on another level. Instead of something, one thing being, it's the humility that comes with the thing is itself a sacrifice. You're sacrificing the ego, and then that fills in the blank. So it's, although Abraham doesn't slice his son, he's still slicing himself in a sense, which I don't know how many like commentators look at it that way, but that's what comes up for me around that. So yeah.
I really wish I had finished watching The Funeral Parade of Roses, but because I feel like there's so much more to that connection there. I guess I'll have to put that on the things to do list. You just got back from a 10-day Vipassana, you said?
Vipassana?
Vipassana?
Yeah, I meditated for 10 hours a day for 10 days.
10 hours a day for 10 days. Where did you do this?
What's that?
Where did you do this? Did you do this at home? Did you travel?
It was way past like Napa area. Like we were out there. I guess you'd say an organization. Like the technique itself is kind of universal, even though they push a lot of Hindu and Buddhist ideas. Like there's a guru thing that's going on, and it's not like openly expressed, which is a little annoying sometimes, but the technique is of huge value. You're basically just you're scanning your body energetically. You just go through and you follow sensation and you go to subtler levels of sensation. I had a very I ended up having a very visionary experience. It was the closest thing to ayahuasca I've ever experienced besides ayahuasca. I was having visions of millipedes and centipedes, like, and very, very strange stuff that was just coming through. It was like the more I would relax into myself and the more I would observe or, you know, feel subtle sensations, the more these visions started to happen. And about 10 years ago, you know, I had a profound experience that opened up. I can feel from inside my skull, the front of my brain all the time. For the last 10 years, it's just been a very dominant thing in my life. And so this felt like it was a huge aid in learning how to use that. I don't feel like I've been using it correctly. I feel like I have at times, but a lot of the time it's not necessarily focused. It's a tool that's not being used appropriately. And so this really helps me use it. And it definitely opened up. I could feel the back of my brain, the medial parts of my brain, just like from inside, like, you know, no bullshit, like opening, expanding, and my visual cortex was definitely activated in that process. And
so you were meditating for 10 hours a day for 10 days. Was this 10 hours of continuous meditation, or morning meditation, afternoon meditation, and evening meditation?
Eat, you know, but the breaks are, you know, I mean, for 10 hours a day, we get up at 4 a.m., you know, it's spread out. There's time to, but even in the quote unquote time, I didn't get a rest. My two roommates were both huge snorers, and they took, so I never take a nap the whole time I was there. So I ended up getting like 5 hours of sleep every night. And I couldn't stop the process. So even though I would sit down for meditation for 10 hours, I was still scanning my body constantly. It was like something was definitely set into motion. And for the first part of it, they just have you focusing on your nose, the area he refers to as a triangle on your face, right? So your nose to the base of your upper lip. And so for 3 days straight, you're supposed to just be concentrating on that. And so I went up at one point because they have you come up and they ask you, you know, quietly, like what's happening for you? Are you able to concentrate and whatnot? And I was like, well, I try to tell them about the front of my brain, and he was like, no, stay down here in this area. And I was saying, well, what about like the top of my nose, like where it meets? And he was like, no, this area. And so sarcastically, I wanted to say, so you'd prefer that I stay at the base of the pyramid? And like, and so I didn't say that, but then I was thinking that at the time. And shortly before they actually teach you, because that's Anapana breathing, but then shortly before they teach you Vipassana itself on the fourth day, I had this moment where I was like, it's not a triangle like he was saying, it's actually a pyramid. And I had a vision that was just very like vivid and real, because I could feel it, of a four-sided, a fifth-sided if you count the bottom, pyramid in my face. So the point, like my nose was one, corner of the pyramid. Mm-hmm. My cheeks were two others, and then the back of my throat was the fourth point. So I just, and it's in my face, and so I was like, the capstone of the pyramid is literally my pituitary, you know, because that's what I was experiencing, was just like this, my head felt like it was like being like anointed in oil, because I could feel my crown like energetically just like, whoa, you know. And so this was like, I could feel a part of my face that I've never actually felt before in this process, because like behind my teeth, like between my nasal cavity, because your nasal cavity, you know, goes up, obviously, nostrils, but then it goes back down. It was like the air traveling up a pyramid, reaching the top to the third eye, and then going back down before it goes into the lungs. And so it was just, you know, in your, you know, I could, the pyramid goes out and then into the air, basically, and where you're sucking in the air, that's like the base of the pyramid. And so like your upper lip is like the base. And so I had this vision, and then, you know, then the process really got going. Like then something was set into motion as soon as that took place. And so, yeah, it was definitely a profound experience.
Do you think that by extricating yourself from the sort of geographic constraint of your normal life, that by leaving where you live and going to a certain place, do you think that that is essential to achieving insights?
No, it's not essential, but it's a motivational factor. Like, are you going to like take the initiative yourself to meditate for 10 hours every day systematically in that way? I felt a lot of the time like they do a degree of guided meditation, and for a certain degree of it, I felt like it was helpful, but there was definitely many, many points where I was just like, shut the fuck up. You know, you have a teacher, you know, chanting and doing different things. His chanting is very strange. He does some weird things with his voice. And that's, I think, part of why I kept on seeing millipedes, was because it was like his expression was just, because I was in this state, I was having a reaction, and that energetic reaction expressed itself as like these millipedes. Very weird. But
you mentioned that it reminded you of ayahuasca.
Yeah.
Do you believe that your experience, I guess, kind of a dumb question, I'll just ask it. Do you believe that your experience with ayahuasca makes you more able to attain certain insights while meditating? Do you feel that it gives you something to draw upon, or something to draw away from, in an effort to get to an energetic place?
I feel like it's pretty straightforward. Those kind of experiences are like can be an aid in an openness and an acceptance of these states. So I can say, long before I ever came across ayahuasca and doing meditation, I've had a degree of the same experience. It's just I've done quite a bit of meditation, but I've never done it this condensed, this systematic, this this much at like at one time. So that feels like that's a huge part of it. I mean, this was something that at any point, if I was motivated enough, I could have experienced, but it took a platform and a format.
But that, to get that platform and that format is that sort of condensing is, or maybe I'm going to throw some words, maybe they don't fit, but the condensing of it or the control of it, being able to separate yourself and go into a 10-day structure, is it something about the structure that provides a foundation for insight? Like, or it's just another aid to getting yourself to a place for I'm trying to say that it's a breakthrough, that you had a breakthrough in this 10 days. Yeah. So without the sort of the rigid structure that you entered into, would that breakthrough have happened, or it's foolish to connect anything? It's just, this is what you did this time and the breakthrough happened. It just, you know what I mean? Is it foolish to connect?
Yeah. I mean, I just go through my days just like I could be doing this, but I'm just not. And so, and then that's inertia, that's momentum. And so this definitely gave me a push. The first couple days were very uncomfortable and I wanted to leave, you know, couldn't leave. For one thing, Amy was there, and that would have been weird if I would have been like, I'm leaving, and I would have had to have gone back and pick. And it just, that wasn't how it needed to go. And so, you know, what happened.
I think of like Danny Torrance going, like his visions in his apartment at home, he's in a situation where he's uncomfortable and would like to leave, right? And is his shining, his visions, a product of being in a rigid and a constructed environment where there's only a few directions one can go to find, for lack of a better word, a solution? Like, are his visions a breakthrough of some sort in the universe of The Shining? Like, is that a healthy solution to being in an uncomfortable position?
Well, the visions were all after the fact. So, and that was, there was plenty of clues to that. So the more, one of the main things that stood in the way of that was actually, any energy of like trying to achieve, of trying to get somewhere. It was actually the exact opposite. So it was the more I would relax and I was just being asked to do one thing. And so if you have 10 hours a day for 10 days, you're only being asked to do one thing, and that's follow something. So, which is not thought. So, which is energy. So you're basically just, can you bring the attention into, say, your hand? Can you then feel your different parts of your arm? How much can you pinpoint any part of your body and feel it? Like, not as an idea, not as a concept, but actually feel. And so the more that I was able to do that and allow that flow to take place, that's when it was accompanied by visions. So the visions are not primary at all. It's they're more interesting to talk about for people when you're going to express. You're like, yeah, I saw crazy alien landscapes and like temples made out of like alien bones, like reaching toward the sky, and like, you know, these orbs and all this stuff. Like, I had like visions that were just coming on their own. Like, I would see like a hound dog and I'd be like, oh, what a pretty dog. And then it would turn its face and it was just like this hanging like pus, like its jaw fucking open and twisted and just like absolutely terrifying. But everything that was coming up, I met with complete equanimity. And so I was also like in some of the worst pain I've ever experienced in my life, because I'm sitting cross-legged, and it's just, it's like if you're doing like an asana pose and you start to feel pain, your natural inclination is to move out of it. So if you're enduring that for an hour or 2 hours and it's excruciating and you're meeting that with total equanimity, and you're still like, instead of just focusing on the area that's in pain, you're bringing attention into your whole body and different areas of your body and exploring that, it's amazing how your attention will actually move off of the pain. So the pain's there, but you're not even like, if you're not focusing on it, it doesn't become the dominant thing. What becomes the dominant thing is the subtleties that are happening all around it. That becomes what's primary. And so there's just a huge opening that comes out of that. But the point is that if you're meeting everything that arises with total equanimity, then insights start to occur on their own. You're not projecting the insights. The insights are revealing themselves. And so, you know, that's a little, I don't know.
Because the concept, I think I understand the concept, especially with sort of the cross-legged lotus position, which is designed to make you uncomfortable. But the point is to transcend the uncomfortable, because really it is illusion, ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was in like half lotus, but the point of lotus, as explained to me by Baba Hari Das, was that it creates a stability, so that when you go into actual paralysis, because you're completely still, you know, and when you're meditating on energy, you reach the same kind of states you reach in deep sleep. So you're basically dreaming while awake, but you're doing it with, like I say, like with full awareness. And so those positions are to maintain stability. If you're not laying on your back, you know, it's pretty easy to fall over.
So considering that what seemingly is represented in a lot of literature nowadays is that DMT is an endogenous chemical, a neurotransmitter in the brain, and DMT is the prime chemical component to ayahuasca. Do you feel that it becomes even more of an obvious sort of relationship that you drew between your visions on ayahuasca and your visions in meditation, and that by keeping yourself still and by sort of allowing the most outermost sensations of your body to sort of not become your focus, that you at some point have to go through the literal occurrence of what science or the literature is telling us is a strong psychedelic, that even those ayahuasca visions are something to be transcended at a certain point.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, and I've had that same sense with on ayahuasca. That, and I've also been very aware of the way that choice plays into it. Like Neo says, the problem is choice, or the problem is joyce. You know, it's like if you're very attuned, you can feel the point at which you can be scanning your body, feeling your body from within, just having a physical sensation experience. And then there's a point at which the imagination will conjure an image, and it's like an avalanche. It's like you give it just a little nudge and the thing just goes, wah, just develops into these like unfathomable, displays of, and it's all you, and it's all your own creation, and it's all your own imagination. It's just, and it doesn't feel like it's you because it's happening so fast. Once it gets going, it spirals off what feels like it's on its own. But I feel like it's like film, where you have the frames are just moving so quickly. You can't tell that they're even frames anymore. It's the same kind of phenomenon. And so it's like, this is me and my projection, but I'm not thinking about it and then seeing it. I'm seeing it and then thinking about it. And because it happens so fast, like I say, you can't tell what the fuck is going on. And so, am I answering what you're...
I'm kind of, this is what I'm kind of hearing is, you reach a point where these visions manifest themselves, but because they're so alien to just the moment prior where you were in meditation, that when they manifest, it manifests almost at the speed of light. You don't go from 0 to 60 and 60 to 120 and then into the speed of, like, you just, you're there. It's just happening. And you're just enveloped inside of it. And it's inside of you. And so it's all happening. And then because you're aware, you kind of like chop it up into snapshots because your awareness is just so fleeting and sort of a staccato awareness at that point. You can't capture it all because it would be gone on some level. So you're getting these little snapshots of what this avalanche is.
Yeah, it's like magic too. It's like sleight of hand.
Okay.
Because the mind enough credit for what it's capable of doing. And so people will see things, but it doesn't feel like it's their own projection, and so they don't think it is.
So Philip K. Dick's experience of seeing and hearing and having his entire reality superimposed by that of biblical times, would you categorize that as something different, or would you categorize this as something within the same realm?
Well, see, this is the value of going into sensation to deeper and deeper, subtler levels, is that you can see what is the undercurrent of what. And so what is like the commonality in, because there's a loop happening, right, that's expressing itself through these archetypes and through these universal symbols and whatnot, right? It's all like embedded in our consciousness. But there's a substratum, an energy substratum that's there in the midst of that, that is like helping to keep the wheel turning, so to speak. And so the rota just keeps on twisting and producing its expression. And the expression remains consistent from time period to time period, from moment to moment on every level. It's like a matrix fractal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's this undernetting, this wiring that's happening through the board. And if the more that you allow your attention to more reside in that place, you're less likely to get caught up in the characters or the representational models. And those have their place for sure. But it's always something deeper. And that's what's expressed. This is something that they kind of touch on a little bit in Vipassana, but Vipassana definitely borrows a lot from Patanjali and the Samkhya-Kartika, where you have this idea of neti-neti, where you have a process of negation, not like the negation in like psychology, but negation in terms of you say not this, and when it comes to the self. So you're like, who am I, right? And you're like, this, anything that can be represented is not yourself. It's like, don't put any God before me. Like, that's how I interpret that. Like, anything that you can, that can stand out in space is never the truth. It's never the highest truth. And so even
okay.
Since.
So, okay. So tell, let me run this by you, because this is the thing I've been sort of trying to formulate for the last 20 years. Okay. So, you know, meditation, I remember meditating for the first time and thinking it was just the stupidest thing in the world. And I couldn't get past myself to just sit quietly and still my mind. It was difficult to just step into that first step of meditation. But once you do it a few times, you kind of transcend those very naive and simple kind of clothes, and you forget about that, and you're kind of on your way. But then I remember the first time I incorporated marijuana in meditation. So I had meditated, and then the next day I had meditated, and the next day I had meditated, and then once I had made a foundation of that sort of space of sort of letting all my thoughts be the clouds and move away and just kind of letting things come arise and just letting them go away and not really attaching myself to anything. Then when I took a little taupe when I was in there, and that whole, you know, chemical reaction or whatever it is with my mind happened. Well, there was a shitload more clouds for me to wrestle with to try to let them pass. And ultimately what happens is it becomes so impossible to ignore the clouds that I had to burst up out of my meditation position and try to write it all down, because what I was seeing was so amazing that I had to, like, this was the thing. This was, I had to share this with somebody. And obviously the things that I wrote down were, turned out to be gibberish the next day. Not necessarily gibberish, but they didn't capture what it was, or they didn't capture those clouds that I just couldn't ignore. So what I basically think of is that that is art, in a sense. What I was trying to do was to try to, had I been a painter, or had I been a guitarist, or had I been into sculpture or whatever, I think I would have jumped out of that meditation position and run to a canvas or run to an instrument, and I would have expressed what that vision was in some sort of artistic creation. And sure. Is that what people would say is, that's like a, that I had cheated myself of something higher by jumping out of my meditation position and attempting to capture what it was that I was essentially instructed to let go?
Well, it's a paradox, right? Because I think it's a reasonable argument to suggest that all art could be considered an aversion to the subtle body. So if you allow yourself to experience the subtle body on a very deep level by bringing your attention into your body, and feel, following the sensation to deeper and deeper levels, that ends up inspiring you, because what accompanies that process, but what's accompanying that process is also the mind attempting to distract you from going even deeper, because you can always go deeper to like infinity's end, right? Mm-hmm. And but distractions are musings. And so you end up creating out of that. But then the action of creating that is that aversion ends up expressing some of the most profound and beautiful art that's around. And so it's a perfect paradox.
But being raised Catholic, the way I later interpreted that was, you know, the story of Christ in the desert, and he's tempted three times, correct? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same thing with Buddha under the tree. There's the three passings in the night where he's meditating under the tree and he's reaching enlightenment, and something appears and offers him, you know, all power in the world. And that's what I felt was being tried to communicate in those stories, is that when you're on the path, and meditation is the first step on the path, you will be greeted by opportunities, but they're really temptations. And you need to strengthen your subtle body to be able to allow those to pass, or to turn them down, or to not... Like, I don't think that the temptations ever disappear in that sort of model. Like,
but you don't get anywhere with aversion, and that's the other part of that. You have to say energetically yes to something, and at the same time not entertain it. It's a very strange thing. Like, you don't feel one way or the other as they arise. And that's actually, like, with Tibetan Buddhism, that's what the bardos are looked at as. You yield to overcome the bardos. Mm-hmm. Right? So we say it's resistance, but it's not resistance as an energetic aversion to the thing. You just allow the thing to be and look at it with total equanimity. You don't have an opinion. It's just allowed to be. So, like, I see a fucking hound dog with its face hanging off, and I look at it completely impartially. Like, there's no... And then I just move on. It's like... It's extremely vivid. And then you'll see the most, like, you know, beautiful, just, like, incredible, like I can't even describe, like, what is occurring. But it's you know, you don't want to get caught up in it. You don't want to get attached to it. You just want to allow it to be.
Really apologize about that.
What was that?
I had to step away real quick, so that sucked. I'm at work, and someone came in and grabbed my attention that I had to jump off. So just like I said, I apologize. If you could just backtrack like 20 seconds, I can catch right back.
Okay. Well, basically, I was just pointing out that though that while you don't want to have an aversion to very almost like terrifying imagery that can arise, like very grotesque imagery. At least this is my experience. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to share this, but I would imagine you. It's the same thing with very beautiful and astounding epic imagery, like glowing like light and things. You don't want to be attached to that either. So it's just whatever it is. That's not what stays primary. What you want to be primary is the actual energy experience. So since Alan came online, I wonder if he's available. Oh, look at that.
Hello?
Hello, Alan.
Hey, how's it going, ma'am?
It's going good. Me and Dave are just talking about Vipassana and the visions that he experienced in his 10-day meditation. Pretty fascinating. How are you doing this morning?
It's 2 p.m. I just woke up. It's been a long work week. But I'm very, very happy to be here. Very happy to hear.
You sound like a beat up Alan Green.
Maybe a little, yeah. But no, please, if you were talking about,
and so I would, I went into the story a little bit of it, but just talking about meditation and some of the values of that. We were initially, before that, we were talking a little bit about Funeral Parade of Roses and Clockwork Orange and Andy Warhol's vinyl, which was the original version of the Clockwork Orange adaptation.
Did you see, so on Wikipedia it states that Funeral Parade of Roses influenced Clockwork Orange, which we could see through like that sped up scene where they're trying to hide the drugs, and it's like all sped up film sort of stumbling over them. It becomes almost like a comedy slapstick little scene with some silly music playing over it. And that's obviously, we can see that in the scene where Alex goes home with the two girls from the record shop and has sex with them.
Totally. And the Corova milk bar is very similar to their.
Oh,
little,
yeah. Yes.
There's just a very.
There's even towards the end of the film, there's the main character with eye makeup on sort of looming over the camera, which is almost the exact same shot can be seen when Alex with his eye makeup on is looming into the camera. It's just like this close up on the face, but from this certain angle, with an emphasis on these dark eyes, and it's a really, really similar shot. So that's all there, but what I was struck by was the correlation between the movie and The Shining.
Totally.
Like, yeah, the fucking, the lipstick and the knife.
Totally.
How the kid is putting on the lipstick so his mother beats him, so he stabs her with the knife and then sleeps with the father. So this idea that in The Shining, Danny picks up the lipstick and the knife when he writes Red Rum and stands over his mother's bed is completely indicative of that. And then, of course, we have this whole angle of you know, Danny and Jack having some sort of sexual undercurrent.
Right. Well, you can see that there's an obvious, openly stated Oedipal influence on this, which is what we were talking about earlier. Yeah. But and then yeah. that through The Shining extremely heavily. So yeah, I feel like there's a common subtextual theme that's taking place, and it has to do with some of the realizations around Oedipus, having to do with fate, playing out of the archetypes unconsciously. There's just a very apparent thing that's being expressed, not to mention that, you know, you have this film, the Andy Warhol's take on it. He has it as vinyl. And then you have, obviously, the record store in A Clockwork Orange, where you can see, you know, Rare Bird and all these classic albums, and obviously 2001, A Space Odyssey. But then you have New Creature, I'm saying my own blog, Magic Mystery Tour on one side, then you have Adam Hart Mother on the other. But that this is also the same theme that these bands were very focused on. And so, and this also has everything to do, with synchronicity. I mean, it's not unknown to Kubrick with 2001 with Echoes. You have Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite, right? He's well aware that Pink Floyd has made the soundtrack to it. There's a few examples of where I don't, my personal, opinion and belief, is that this is something that's not just pure like universe synchronicity, but this is an intentional thing that took place. I feel that Pink Floyd made Echoes to go with Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. And so you can see when he has Adam Hart Mother up there, it's a total sync wink. And so I got to wonder too, with the Beatles and whatnot, like it feels like there's something going on there. But that the specifically that you have Jupiter, obviously the god Jupiter, Danny's 42 and this and that, that there's definitely some little, play that's taking place. And it to me, it feels relatively conscious. And so, yeah. That's part of the Oedipus thing in the first place, is that you have people trying to escape from these archetypal roles, yet they fall into them anyway. This feels like a case of people consciously saying yes to the roles and seeing where that goes, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Even the idea that, you know, we can kind of look at in 2001, right? We all know that originally it was supposed to be Saturn, and then they changed it to Jupiter, right?
Which just seems like Kubrick's explanation about room 237, that he didn't use room 217 because the staff at the hotel. It just seems like it's something they say, but it always meant to be Jupiter. I mean, that's just my opinion.
Well, I guess what I was going to say is there's something in the change itself. Right. So particularly in 2001, Saturn comes with its archetypal baggage and Jupiter comes with its archetypal baggage. But having the book be Saturn and having the movie be Jupiter adds a third layer of I know you guys have read some of Suicide Kings, this idea of it's Saturn is overthrown by Jupiter. So my sort of point here is you have the son overthrowing the father. In the same way, so the way the story goes, right? Uranus, the sky god, has sex every night with the earth and makes all these children. They are the Titans, blah, 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 all these sort of monsters and abortions and things like that. And then you have the idea that then one of those kids is destined to overthrow the father, so he eats his children, right? This is Saturn eats his children. This is something that we've talked about a number of times with The Shining, the idea of this idea of pedophilia also being representative of Saturn eating his children.
Who are the
Donner?
Who are the Donner Party? Oh, they're a group
yeah,
of...
Yeah, exactly. The Donner Party. You mean they ate them up? So, exactly. So you have this idea of the family eating itself, which can be manifested as pedophilia or the Donner Party or all these different subtexts. But it's basically the same thing. This is, as LeClaire would say, this is Saturnine energy at play, right? But the idea of going then from Saturn to Jupiter, Jupiter is Saturn's sun. Jupiter is Saturn's sun. So that's the idea of the son overthrowing the father here. But then, of course, Jupiter does the same damn thing. And with Minerva, Athena, things like that. So you have the same archetype continues to play out, but in subtle variations of it. And to me, there's something, you know, this is, we always get into tricky territory. We say, what was this? Was this intentional by Kubrick or not? But to me, having, if you just had it as Saturn, it's one thing. If you just had it as Jupiter, it's another. But by having it as Saturn and then, oh, we need to change it to Jupiter, I feel like it just, it's a, becomes a home run.
Yeah, it's too perfect.
Yeah.
Totally. And so obviously you can see the Oedipus thing, which is the same Saturn-Jupiter thing playing out. You kill the father, fuck the mother, playing out at the end of The Shining, especially with the end playing, which I am personally obsessed with. But the fact that all throughout, like, you can see the mythological theme that's taking place feels very, very apparent and rather overt at times. And so, yeah, it's interesting.
So with Jupiter being Saturn's sun, that is just a pun on Jupiter being the second sun in our solar system. Like, absolutely. How in 2010 you have the star child merging, or the monolith merging with Jupiter and forming it into a second sun. It's sort of an enlightened understanding that that brings light to the world. So it's a sort of light bringing Lucifer type thing.
Yeah, which is what's interesting with Star Wars having Tatooine with the two suns, and then somehow there's this alignment with Pink Floyd's The Final Cut with two suns in the sunset, could be the human race's run. Like, that's quite a thing to stop and ponder. Like, why is he saying could be the human race's run? Because we're playing out a drama. And what does that have to do with there being two suns in the sunset? And this other sun, the Jupiter sun, feels like it's the archetype that we're unconsciously playing out, this pattern. And so that is also the same pattern that's being expressed with the genocide, where you say it on an individual level, where you're looking at it with the king kill and these individual entities, but it's also happening on a mass scale, because we are basically eating ourselves, and we are playing out this total atrocity against one another, and then we suffer amnesia and we forget. And then we do it all over again. And so that was actually, I don't remember who, maybe it was John Fell Ryan I don't remember who it was in Room 237 who was pointing the amnesia side of that out when it comes to genocide. But that was one of the things that really stuck, that I had to really kind of meditate on, was just like, oh, wow, we do this over and over again. And then we do it and we forget, and then we do it and then we forget, you know. And that's also like with Poltergeist, you know, that we're building on top of the path. We build on top of the graveyard, and then it comes up to haunt us. And then, you know, and then we do it all over again. And that's the other side, you know.
That's the record skip at the end of Sergeant Pepper's, right? It just never could be any other way. It just keeps skipping and repeating into infinity. Which is pretty frightening. I always imagined that would have been a frightening end to that album, but I'm kind of sensitive. But if you had first spun that record in 1967 and heard that, it must have been pretty disorienting.
Yeah, especially in some of the states that people would get themselves into the first time they listen to a new.
Yeah, we were at Jimmy's house, and what the fuck? So, you know, now that we're all here, I know me and Alan had discussed over the last 2 weeks sort of a state of the always record conversation to kind of get into looking at what we've accomplished and kind of where we're going with Always Record. And I figured this is a perfect time to kind of open that topic up, don't you think?
Sure.
Sure.
Alan, I want to
you know, you sucked me into a Kubrick conversation, but if you want to suck me back out, it's all right.
Hey, I want to say great work with the first edition of Synchronize. I thought that was really, really well done.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's it was a lot of work, and all on a sort of short. Again, if something just kind of snowballed that was like, hey, we have this idea. What if we did it like this? What if we did it like this? And once we started working on it and the things, I was going to say something that would have sounded like I was making a pun. I was going to say things exploded. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? I'm really not trying to make a pun, but to say as a news story happened that everyone started going, oh my God, this is Synchy for this reason and for this reason and for this reason and this reason. And just the material, it sort of seemed to strike a nerve where there was an outpouring of content. I know for myself, I mean, this event was so heavily interconnected with everything I've been working on, but then it was so heavily interconnected with everything that Jason was working on, and it's so connected with everything et cetera, that it sort of seemed like, well, here's the perfect opportunity to, if the plan was to kind of take a theme and get different people's perspectives on it, this was the perfect thing to sort of start with and at least try it out. That's why we did it as a pilot episode, was to say, like, let's just try it. We have these ideas of how it would kind of work, but let's just try it and see what that actually would be like. But I think it was pretty successful. I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah, Dave, did you get a chance to check that out?
Got a chance to check it out. I will soon. That's awesome, though. I was surprised. I thought when I first looked at my Facebook when I got back and I saw the image of it, and I was like, oh, there's a new Sync show, and I didn't know anything about it, and so I was trying to scramble together to figure out what was going on, but it looks awesome. It's a good idea.
It's so obviously one of the things this is how this relates to Always Record is one of the things we've been talking about is saying we need some. Well, there was a feeling that I was expressing was that we needed something that was more accessible. You know, something that's able to go into some of the tangents that we do here, but have a like find that happy medium between 42 minutes and Always Record, and not because either of those are bad formats, but to find something that if someone, you know, if someone feels intimidated by, hey, Always Record is a 3-4 hour show, or it's sort of very loose conversation sometimes, and it's not something like I know I find them incredibly enjoyable to listen to. And we have had some really, really nice feedback about Always Record. And then we've also had feedback of people saying this is sort of inaccessible.
Right.
So it was how do
gems?
What's that?
How do you? Well, you get gems that you end up that you wouldn't stumble upon if you hadn't looked at it from so many angles.
Precisely.
To just come down to like what is? I don't even know how to approach this. It makes perfect sense. Yeah, I like it.
So this is sort of like, well, I don't want to neuter Always Record. I want it to be this space where this is essentially a, you know, what you might have like a writer's room or a or just, you know, just a round table like conversation. Okay, this is where the ideas are explored in depth, where things can change and shift. I feel like the development, personal development that I've had out of Always Record for the last year that we've been doing it has been tremendous, tremendously helpful and informative. So I don't want to exactly, I don't know, like Bill has mentioned to me multiple times, well, okay, we've done that and we've developed this for a year. Now what do we do with it? So I had at first asked the question was, well, do we want to do something where we take Always Record and try and kind of put it into a little bit more of a format or a container, or, you know, maybe that we record for 3 hours, but then we edit that down, or do we, you know, just all the different ideas that came about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I felt like doing that to Always Record would kind of defeat the purpose of it. Like it is a special thing. I don't know if it, maybe it doesn't appeal to everybody, or, you know, if some people find that much audio intimidating. I totally get that, but I still think it, you know, it's there for those who want to dig that deep. So I just felt like, you know, whatever we decide to do with this, we want to make some small changes or things like that. But I just felt like to try and put it into a container didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So it was like, okay, well then let's do it with a third option. Let's kind of see if, let's try something that's, has some of, you know, 42 minutes formality, but some of Always Record's kind of playfulness, and, you know, multiple takes, you know, multiple perspectives, I mean, and, try and kind of find some middle ground there while at the same time making it something that hopefully, well, so our intent was to make a show that was accessible to not necessarily your 42 degree synchro mystic, you know, but maybe to your, you know, your friend who, you have a friend who like, oh yeah, I like 2001 A Space Odyssey, you know, and that's about as deep as it goes. You could start to kind of like hold their hand and be like, hey, did you ever check this out? So the idea was to kind of like make it a lot more accessible to mainstream. I'll be honest, I don't know if we were successful in that part, in the sense that I feel like the esotericism got pretty hot and heavy fast. Bill, did you feel that way?
It kind of did.
Yeah.
You know, and to be honest, you know, the Kabase Bala, we forget just how foreign and alien that sounds to the average person to even make that kind of joke and then to go into what Andras was sort of mapping out.
Yeah.
It's just not accessible at all to the average person. Even to most people, I think what I've learned too about from the kitchen sink and from this is that as much as I think I don't know yet, this has helped me to appreciate what I do know and what I'm aware of, but I've also come to a huge appreciation for what others don't know, if I'm saying that correctly. That, like, I just assume when everyone's posting on Kitchen Sink or making comments that they've read everything I've read. You know what I mean? That they've checked out everything. And it's just not true. That's just a failure of my own, you know, personal perspective. And that's something that has been great that I've been able to learn, is that, you know, we all have our own individual stockpiles of information. So I think that the format of Synchronize is digestible, but the content definitely needs to be tailored to a wider market, because that's the whole point of it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this is a good segue, though, because one of the things I've thought about with Always Record that we could do that would be sort of allowing Always Record to be more focused without, you know, cutting the balls off the whole idea. So something like, what if we did a show where, hey, this episode we're going to talk about the structure of the Tree of Life, you know, how it corresponds to Tarot and Hebrew letters and such and such. just dissect that almost, you know, like a class style, but also somewhat of a, you know, it could still be open to discussion, where people are throwing things in. But maybe what we need to do, and again, because there are plenty of things I don't know that I want to know more about, but then there are plenty of things, as you said, where it's like, I know this and I expect other people to know this. Maybe that's the way we start to do, you know, like maybe that's an idea at least, is to kind of take a week and try and dissect something and try and introduce people to these different ideas. And if it's something we're not familiar enough with, that's when we bring a guest on who is well versed in that. Hey, we've been having this conversation. We're trying to figure out, sacred geometry and my math skills aren't so great. Or, you know, we make these conversations about quantum reality, but I'm no physicist. Can we bring somebody in who can try and explain that to us and our listeners at the same time?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we first started Always Record, that was what the direction I thought we were going into. But I think we all kind of realized that for what was actually happening, we were just personally more interested in just going off on whatever tangent we could. So, like, remember we did that one episode where we started with the Doors, and we were kind of like focusing on that. I had rewatched the Doors movie and I had read up about it, and I kind of came to the table with the stockpile, but I quickly realized that coming to that format with that stockpile, it didn't integrate itself into the flow of the conversation, and then we were off and running, and Always Record has been what it has been.
When I explain what I feel like the show is to people, I usually express that we are it's experimental in the sense that we are taking different schools of thought that tend to be rather compartmentalized, and see what happens when we bring them together. And so that also goes from arcane school to arcane school, but we treat pop culture and media with the same kind of, we treat it in the same way as we would say, we see how it all applies together. And it's the merging of these different schools of thought that bring out different ideas that wouldn't otherwise be available or considered. And so that, for me, feels like it's been like the main theme of the show, which is what fascinates me and interests me and what I'm called to do. Now, when it comes to, Kabbalah's one thing, but the different sciences, these different ideas, like that, those are all things that are available to people, and we live in an information age where those kind of schools of thought are more available than they ever have been. So if you're interested in one of these subjects, you can, that didn't feel like that's as much of what we're here for. We're here to see how these different things apply. So you do what, and it's unfortunate if people feel at times like they're being like left behind or something, or they're not being filled in. But we do our best to show where people are interested in this stuff, where they can look it up. Like, there's no secret where we're getting our information. We don't have like some secret source that we're pulling from. We have sources that are available to anybody who cares to look into it. Yeah.
That's actually a great point. That is a great point. Yeah, it's like there's for the actual information, you can do your own research, but for the application, there's no one else doing that.
That's what we're here doing. I mean,
yeah, I just don't know if it makes for a very, like, it's a very niche show. So the point is I think for Alan and you and everyone who's really busy, the time that you have is valuable. Are we comfortable throwing our time and effort into a very, very niche show Or do we feel like we can go in a different direction to put energy into something that is a little broader and maybe brings more people into the fold? Like, do we, which is what Synchronize is a good model for.
But also that's why, so to say the Synchronize model should not necessarily be the always record model. I think my point was, when I first had this thought like a few weeks ago and was trying to figure this out, is it's like, wow, okay, so we're doing stuff that seems really dense. For people who aren't familiar with this, it seems incredibly dense, not just in the length of the content, but in the variety of things they might have to be familiar with, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what I was trying to think is, do we make this more accessible to a wider audience? And I'm considering David's argument and my own argument from a few weeks ago, and I feel like the idea that this is the place where, you know, if we're take the, you know, you, Bill, you used the musician example. If we are a jam band and we all come together and, okay, you know, I'm the drummer, you're the guitarist, you're the singer, or whatever, you know, it's like, hey, let's just get together and see what we can do here and figure this out. We don't then, you don't go to a concert and the guy doesn't say, now I'm going to show you how to get a C chord, or, you know, something. So maybe this is what, Bill, you had used the phrase, something like, this is what a conversation should sound like. I don't know if you remember what you were saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe you want to repeat that here for David.
It's just the sense that when the Boston bombing occurs, what should people who have integrated sync into their model of the way reality works, if you've integrated sync into your model of reality, this is what a conversation about the Boston bombing sounds like. You don't just go, this syncs, and that's connected to the sync. It just, you bring your entire self into the conversation with the assumption that synchronicity is part of the fabric of reality, and it's not something to be dismissed as woo-woo or, you know, crazy thinking. It's just as important as the political angle, the cultural angle, the social angle. It's just part of the fabric. And when you integrate it into that fabric, this is what conversation sounds like. So